I know. I saw Tobias speed as I pulled into the garage. I said, oh, I'm not all that late myself then.
Good morning, everyone. I am today convening our Revenue Committee hearing. We're going to have a start this morning with an informational meeting about cash flow. And Mr. Warner, if you would introduce the subject.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it was about a week ago in our discussion around reserve funds, the issue of cash flow, general fund cash flow, came up. And DAS has been tracking that very closely over the years. And also, of course, the Treasury manages our cash flow position. So we've asked Mark Medema to come over from DAS and Darren Bond and Cora Parker from the Treasury to talk about our cash flow for the general fund. And then the bills we have scheduled after this informational do have implications for general fund cash flow.
Thank you. Please, our guests, if you'd come forward as a group and... We appreciate you being here. Welcome, Mr. Medema. We've not met. I'll have you start because I know you have to be somewhere soon. And if you just identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Medema. I'm with Budget and Management and work extensively on the general fund cash flow when we do our tax anticipation note borrowings. And I've plagiarized a lot of that material to walk you through today. So basically, in front of you, you should have some charts. And basically, on these lines, what you'll see is the revenue numbers, or the line is in green. Expenditures are in red. And then you can kind of see the cash balance. And this is a cash flow that would anticipate not having borrowed tax anticipation notes. You'll notice pretty much that the cash balance is below the zero mark for 98% of the biennium. You'll also notice on those expenditure numbers that in a biennium, we spend about 52% of our general fund in the first fiscal year, 48% in the second. Revenue is kind of the reverse. 48% of it comes in the first fiscal year and 52% in the second. You'll also notice there's lots of expenditures in July. That's because of the double school fund payment. And then in June, expenditures go way down. And, you know, in the middle of the drought graph there, you'll notice that the June cash balance goes up because of estimated payments and so forth coming in and no, you know, not big payments going out.
Yeah, Representative Brewer.
Thank you. Just to clarify, what metrics, what number scale are you using? What does 1500.0 mean?
That would be 1.5 billion.
Billion. Thank you.
So those are in millions. So this chart basically, like I said, anticipates without having tax anticipation notes. However, we did do a TANS borrowing. So the next page you'll see is the cash flow with the tax anticipation notes. You'll notice the cash balance stays above the zero line most of the biennium. There are some IRS considerations, so we only borrow until June 30, and then we pay off the TANs, and we would reborrow again in July. I won't go into those unless somebody really wants to get into esoteric IRS code, but I don't think you really care about that.
There may be one among us who would, but we are going to shout her down.
I'll pass.
Representative Barnhart.
I am curious about how you manage being $500 million short in June.
Basically,
cash.
There's the inter-fund borrowables. What I've done is... Treasury has about $14.5 to $15 billion of interfund money that if the general fund uses that money, the general fund pays interest, okay? So that's always available, but it's a lot cheaper for us to borrow TANs. Our current TANs are 0.39%, Treasury's earning 0.5%, and so, you know, it's a lot cheaper money to just do the TANs and not... and allow the general fund to earn at that higher taxable rate.
TANs being tax anticipation notes.
Yes.
Thank you.
I had that in my notes, too, like that. But anyway, and then you can kind of see at the end where we do come back, and also I would point out that the... Here you see in the revenues and in the expenditures the July, the TANs revenue is there, and then you'll also see the June expenditures are higher, but then the July revenues are higher. This last time we borrowed $850 million. And then the remaining pages in the packet that you have, and I apologize for the small print.
Oh my gosh, I can't
see that. This is the month-to-month cash flow display that goes into the official statement. It basically just supports those prior sheets. If anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to talk about them with you. But, you know, like I said, from your standpoint, I think really what you guys were looking for was what happens to the general fund, you know, what's kind of a, what's the cash flow look like, and then, like I said, how we have taken to managing that with the tax anticipation notes at the least cost to the state. So with that, I will open it up for questions, or if Mr. Bond has anything you'd like to add.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I know the answer, but I'm not sure, so I'm going to ask. Under personal income tax, the second real row in your chart, you show a negative in October and November. How's that happen? Is it
in 07-09, we had the $1.1 billion kicker payment. That's money that's getting pulled back over to Department of Revenue to be able to make out that December payment.
I think that relates to a bill we have later.
Yes, yeah, it does. I think it does, Madam Chair.
So, yeah. That's
thank you. That does answer that question.
So, any other questions? Yes, Representative Benz.
Madam Chair, is the $500 million the most that we generally borrow, or have we borrowed more than that? And if so, is there a limit on how much you would feel comfortable with our borrowing using the tax anticipation notes?
The tax, Chair Berger, Representative Benz, the tax anticipation notes, we typically borrow somewhere between $700 and $850 million. And that really is, we have to look at where the lowest point of the cash flow is going to be during the first 6 months of borrowing. And then we, in essence, size it according to that, and that's, again, based on IRS regulations as to how we size those note borrowings.
Follow up.
I recall a conversation with one of the Treasury's folks 2 years ago after the crash, so to speak, and the great difficulty in, or the challenge, the anticipated challenge of short-term borrowing. I take it that because we're borrowing from ourselves, and I think, in fact, that we did some legislative fixes to make sure that we could, but is this device in any way linked to outside influences, that is, can we borrow from ourselves at will, or is there something else that might prevent us from so easily assessing this needed short-term capital?
Madam Chair, if I might, for the record, I'm Darren Bond, the Deputy State Treasurer. Representative Benz, we have access to a significant amount of resources internally to borrow. The issue is that those funds are all managed on behalf of other various statutory and constitutionally dedicated funds. They're all invested in the taxable markets, earning taxable returns. So if we loan the money out, for instance, to the general fund to cover these deficits, then taxable rates have to be paid back to recompense the funds that are loaning them, ultimately it provided that money. By accessing the capital markets, we get to go out and borrow at tax-free rates, non-taxable rates. So the general fund is advantaged through the use of the tax-free borrowings in the capital markets. And then additionally, as you know, as the flows, you know, as the cash ebbs and flows, there can be periods of time where there are positive balances, and of course in those periods of time then the general fund is earning that positive incremental return, and that arbitrage is not you know, it's accrues to the state. So
please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question, of course, I appreciate that. And
sure.
The question, though, is what if any restrictions are there on the use of that device? Is it merely having the money available, or are there in statute restrictions that would prevent us from so easily accessing other funds for the purpose of carrying us through these times of cash shortfall?
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, if I could clarify, are we talking about the device being the tax anticipation notes?
Yes.
Tax anticipation notes are, there's a really tight regulatory construct devised by the IRS about how we can go about using tax anticipation notes. And so, and part of this, if you want to make sure that they stay tax-free, which is really critical to our borrowers, then we have to make sure that we're not borrowing more than we need to borrow. And they have, you know, and it's all, the methods are lined out. Mark has to make sure that he keeps the documentation to evidence that we have followed the rules so that our notes don't become taxable. The relative to the short-term fund, we do have, and really what precipitated this, I don't know, Paul, when did we start? It's like 2004 or something?
2002 was the first
borrowing. 2002. We did have sizable interfund borrowings to the general fund and sizable interest liabilities from the general fund. And so we looked at what the options were out there at the time Treasury and DAS pursued, came to the legislature to get legislation to allow us to issue tax anticipation notes to be able to fund, you know, kind of one more tool in the toolkit to be able to most cost-effectively manage the state's cash. If, you know, going back to Measure 5, Measure 50, et cetera, it significantly changed the structure of the state's cash flows. And up to that time, we didn't run this kind of a structural deficit. We had, there were deficit periods, but also at that time, generally, the budget carried much larger, relatively much larger beginning and ending balances. And with the changes, with bringing on schools, with the way the cash flows changed, this picture you see of this structural cash flow deficit, this big belly in the cash flows, is chronic. These are Oregon's cash flows. And for the foreseeable future, they're going to be Oregon's cash flows. And so the magnitude, again, is dependent on the size of the budget, and more importantly, it's dependent on the size of the beginning and ending cash balances. And so the tax anticipation note tool provides us about the most cost-effective way we have to manage that. Now, I would point out that we have encouraged the legislature over the years in when we talk about the rainy day fund, of making sure we put the rainy day fund, setting it up as a proprietary account in the general fund. And one of the advantages to that is that cash, not for budget purposes, but for cash flow purposes, then the balance in the rainy day fund becomes available to offset these deficits and minimizes the amount of external borrowing that we have to do. So from a cash flow perspective, that's the logical and sensible place to put it, and we've advocated that for years, and that's currently how the current rainy day fund is set up.
Please continue.
Thank you.
I am enjoying this line of questioning very much.
I guess, just so I'm clear on the tax anticipation notes, then, are for the purpose of evidencing a loan, an in-house loan, so to speak, or are they going outside and borrowing?
Outside.
Outside. And so then is the state, in effect, reliant upon the availability of that credit market to cover that need? Because I recall in 08, where that wasn't available, people weren't loaning money for a period of a couple of weeks. And I'm just curious what we would do if that happened again.
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, yes, we are dependent on the capital markets. We always have the backstop of interfund borrowing. It just costs more. If we go back to 08, what we actually saw, it was the weekly reset paper where the market completely dried up. Tax anticipation notes are generally 13-month notes. Can't be longer than that. We actually issue 12-month notes. They can't be longer. So we issue a longer-term note, and we also have generally a higher credit and a better, a very good reputation for how we manage this cash. Our market never dried up.
Thank you.
So.
Yes, Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for this information on general fund. I can't really read the spreadsheet, but I will one day. I am very interested, though, in the total cash of the state, including the other funds and the other $50 billion sitting out there. Maybe we could talk at some point on how the other funds work into the management of our state, because this is obviously a very small portion.
Would you like to speak to that, Mr. Mayor?
Actually, I would defer to Mr. Bond.
Madam Chair, relative to the $65 billion of funds, much of that is, of course, tied up and, invested in a broad array of assets on behalf of OPERF, SAFE, the Common School Fund, et cetera. We do, when you are able to make Mark give you a magnifying glass so that you can actually read his spreadsheets and the cash flows, we do identify certain backstop resources that are available to the state to support our borrowing. We call those interfund resources, and we look at that through interfund borrowing, which there's an established set of statutes that addresses interfund borrowing for the state, and that's managed by Treasury. I believe we have usually somewhere between $12 and $14 billion of interfund borrowable resources that are available, again, as a backstop to the borrowing. And what's really important about that is when we go out to the market, investors want to see that they're going to get repaid. And so here we have a two-year projection of revenues that we say are going to provide resources to make sure you get repaid. And they like to say, okay, what else? Well, our interfund borrowable resources are our what else. And we have a very large, significant chunk of those. Our first stop always is the Oregon Short-Term Fund, which is the state and local government working capital. And we look to that as that's, for one thing, it's easy. It's very available, readily liquid. We look to that first. We do have, through the Oregon Short-Term Fund Board, the governing body, and the Oregon Investment Council, which the board reports to, we do have restrictions on the size of the borrowings that can go out at that for any particular agency, and a separate one for the general fund. We limit borrowings to 10% of the balance of the short-term fund. Generally, the short-term fund is sitting around $10 or $11 billion. I think it's about 11 and a half or somewhere around there right now.
Please. Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to have a discussion. It's still a big, and I appreciate your answer. Thank you. I would like to know more of how the bigger piece of the pie works into our overall state budget. And when we have $10 or $11 billion sitting over there for our short-term fund, when we're not borrowing under interfund balance, what is going on with that? And who benefits from the, I'm assuming it's invested somehow, even if it's just at interest. How does that all work? Because it's still a big missing piece of management of the state to me as a legislator that I'd like to know.
Madam Chair, do you want me to address that now?
Well, yes, and I think that the Treasury needs to have some further conversations with this
Absolutely.
Legislature too, because with perhaps others. Yes, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Ira Brewer. The Oregon Short-Term Fund is kind of like a money market mutual fund, more or less. We have, at any given time, again, $10, $11, $12, $13 billion, depending on the cash flows of state agencies and local government customers. We invest that. it isn't sitting idle anywhere, anytime. We're investing that in various kinds of money market instruments. And from, you know, from corporate notes to treasuries, agencies, commercial paper, et cetera. That fund is managed internally by the state treasury. We have our own investment staff that manages that on a daily basis. It provides daily liquidity to state agencies and local governments. We have, it's about, and generally it's a fairly even split between local government and, thanks Mark, and state agency money can shift, you know, but generally it's about a 50-50 split. It provides, again, it's a significant source of liquidity. It's Oregon has the benefit of having a very sophisticated cash management, cash mobilization process, where we're able, because Oregon has had the benefit of, for years, a broad branch bank system here. We're able to access the state's funds with a minimum amount of bank relationships, bring that money in and work it very rapidly. And so we have, we leave virtually no money on the table. And so it's a very effective process. It's very cost efficient, and that's why we have, you know, $5 or $6 billion of local government money at any given time.
We should probably talk offline because I'm not sure I don't know if we're understanding each. I understand what you're saying. I don't know if my question's being understood because I'm probably not asking it correctly. So we should probably talk offline.
Well, I don't want to cut this discussion.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
Committee members, we started to talk about cash flow, but we have quickly gone into the entire and understandably into the bigger picture of what our state's financial situation is and how it works and how the Treasury works, and this is an important discussion that I think we may have to get to in another time. But Representative Barnhart,
thank you, Madam Chair. One of the bills that I've been working on, which is actually not in this committee, has to do with the Finance and Credit Board. As a part of the conversation around the way in which we manage Oregon economic development funds, I think the whole discussion of the state funds in general opens up. And it's part of that conversation. And I think it would be a great conversation to have in this committee if we can figure out a time and a way to do that.
Yeah, I was going to suggest that we bring Treasury in and others to have a more thorough vetting of this bigger issue of the funds and how they work and how they interwork. And we will, I think, Mr. Chair, schedule something for this committee.
And how they're coordinated or not coordinated.
Exactly.
Right.
Mr. Bond,
at your convenience.
I am sure, because this is important. And then also credit rating and how that plays in. And because the state of Oregon is a large financial institution, there is no question. So any further questions around cash flow that we can... and so anticipation of you coming back, members... get your questions ready, and if you have specific ones ahead of time of a hearing from the Treasury, let us know, and we'll make sure that they answer specific. Okay?
Madam Co-Chair.
Yes.
Just the one that I sure would like to have addressed is the safety issue who's holding the billions and how safe are they? I know we've heard this before, but it'd be very interesting to hear it again.
Sure.
Thank you.
Anything else? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Bond. Thanks for coming in. This has been a very interesting discussion, and I will get my magnifying glass, too, because, frankly, that's a pretty small print. All right. Members of the committee, we have a couple of bills. I think I'm going to open with House Bill. I'm going to open House Bill 2612. Are you the Mazin? If you'd like to talk about it for us.
Chair Berger, members of the committee, the House Bill 2612, I think, attempts to try and make the deposits within the state banking institution go under different types of definitions of what those deposits are. It primarily has to deal with the uninsured deposits. And if you go through the bill, I think there are a few things that make, as you see in Section 1, it says that it used to say where the deposits of the government would be in different institutions at 100%, 150%, 200%, and then 30% in D in line 14, page 1. That this basically allows or changes the game slightly by injecting the word uninsured public funds into these definitions. So now all these percentages are going against only the uninsured public funds rather than total public funds. In effect, what this would do is increase the amount that these deposit institutions can have from public funds. And you have in Section 2 that includes the credit unions in the same formulas. However, some of this bill might, things might become a little redundant, especially 14D, when it specifies that 30% of the aggregate uninsured public funds, although the top was to, the whole idea was to make the aggregate uninsured public funds, which makes it a little contradictory and redundant, at least in from this very quick way of looking at it. But I'm sure that we would learn a lot more from this. I asked the State Treasury also, Dunn is here, and we've talked about this over the last few days. DCBS, who regulates banks, thought that it's probably also the Treasury's business, and they didn't want to speak to it.
Okay. I didn't understand any of that, Mazin.
Madam Chair, just to, by way of background, this is a companion bill, I think, to House Bill 2613, which passed the House and went to the Senate, which deals with a semi-related issue, and that is the issue of how you can spread deposits around between various banks in order to obtain federal insurance, because you've got the limit, a limited amount in each bank below the limit, or at or below the limit of the insurance. And as I understand it, the purpose of this bill is to try to make it clear that the rule for collateralization of deposits is that it's only the uninsured amount of the deposit that has to be collateralized. Now, if Mazin is concerned about the language, I think we better look at it pretty carefully to make sure that we haven't got redundancies and we haven't got things that are contradictory in the bill, because this is all part of the process of trying to deal with the issue that came up last session, when we simply said, if you're going to take public funds under some circumstances, you're a small institution, you're going to collateralize all of it. And if you recall, that issue didn't come to this committee either. It went through the Rules Committee. So I don't believe this committee has ever directly dealt with this issue before today.
I remember it from a different committee, too.
Yeah, and I wasn't on that committee then, but I do remember being very concerned when the bill came to the floor, because it seemed to me that it was utterly unworkable. It has proved to be utterly unworkable.
Wait a minute.
From the standpoint of the smaller institutions, because they can't accept public deposits under those circumstances, because they have to lend out money in order to make money.
Well,
but this issue, while it's technical, is really important to get it right. so that we don't put public money at risk.
I totally agree. Mr. Bond, would you like to come forward and give us a little vetting on where we're going with this?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Darren Bond, Deputy State Treasurer. I warn you, I really wasn't prepared to talk on this.
That's
today,
okay. You're in the hot seat anyway.
But I can, since I've unfortunately shepherded this process for decades, it seems.
You're not that old, Mr. Bond.
Actually, I am. The bill is trying to, it's, by the way, it's not our bill, but we don't have any issue with it. It's making a definitional change. So what the bill addresses is currently in statute, a bank can only hold certain amounts of public funds deposits, and they can't hold deposits in excess of a certain percentage of their net worth. And so and that net, those net worth limits are defined in the statute. Currently, that's based on aggregate public funds deposits held by the institution. This change says that that comparison is only appropriate to their uninsured public funds deposits, which is fine. We're fine with that. You know, theoretically, you can have a little additional concentration risk in a given institution. Practically, in Oregon, the way our banking environment is structured, we don't believe that's a real concern, and apparently DCBS doesn't because they're not here. And they're really the ones that should opine on that. That's their game. So we don't have any issues with the bill. I don't agree with Mazin relative to the conflicts in the bill, in that those are speaking to two different issues. One is your overall limits for a particular institution relative to their net worth. The 30% of public funds deposit is to limit concentration of public funds deposits in any given institution. So the idea is that if an institution holds more than 30% of the aggregate public funds of the state and local governments combined, then they're going to have to pledge 100% collateral to support that. Because this is backed by a collateral pool, all banks participating in holding public funds deposits share the liability of loss. So this is a way that that loss, that potential liability, can be mitigated. Now, this bill originally, this structure, came from the banks. The banks and actually local governments created the shared liability pool structure that we now have, centralized this into treasury management, created a significant amount of efficiencies, you know, systemic efficiencies in how we administer public funds. But there is, as Representative Barnhart points out, you know, we have come through a significant period of dislocation in the financial markets. And all across the country, and Oregon was not immune. And we have, with the participation of DCBS, and actually at the request of the banking industry, we did move all banks to collateralizing at 100% through the worst of the times to ensure the public funds were safe. We did, I don't know how long, a month or 6 weeks ago perhaps, we did reduce the minimum amount or the maximum amount of collateral or minimum amount, I guess that would be appropriate, sorry, to 70% of public funds deposits for the bulk of public funds depositories. So that did free up a portion of that. And we anticipate as the environment continues to improve that we'll be able to continue to ratchet that minimum collateralization number back down and continue to free up capital. Concurrently, the Treasurer has an effort going on with our federal delegation and others to try to make this whole system make more sense, because it's crappy.
You're talking about, I mean, I know that's technical, but you're talking about the whole system
not just the Oregon.
Not just the Oregon.
You're not talking about our system being that way.
No, actually, as far as our system goes, we do have a fairly elegant system now.
I was going to say,
systems in general, if you were a bank having to deal across multiple jurisdictions, then for every jurisdiction you deal with, potentially you're dealing with a different collateralization regime. So administratively, that's costly. And it's not free for us to run. And when you look at the system, there's already a system in place to insure deposits. It just doesn't specifically call out public funds deposits, and that's FDIC insurance. And so we're pursuing the possibility of a federal program where an institution that wants to participate in the public funds market could purchase additional insurance through the FDIC and provide full coverage to that. The administrative benefit of that seems to be quite significant. And then you could eliminate collateralization programs all across the country, freeing up literally hundreds of billions of dollars of capital that could be lent out through communities across the country. Right now, I believe there's about $2.5 billion of collateral pledged just in Oregon.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Representative Juan, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions. what's the name of the insurance that we have for deposits of public funds currently under current law?
Madam Chair, Representative Juan, it's FDIC insurance. The Public Funds Collateralization Program is a separate program where banks pledge collateral to support their public funds deposits.
If I, please. Thank you. So what, for public funds, what are the limits of the insurance under the FDIC?
Madam Chair, Representative Juan, you have me at a disadvantage because
the bankers are in the room and they may be able to answer that question.
They change them fairly. It's at least $250,000 per deposit. There was a period of time where transaction accounts were insured fully. I don't know if they're still doing that.
Okay.
yes, they are.
We will quickly get to them. Yes,
but that is a program that's slated to end. So.
And then last question is, the public funds collateralization program, is that over and above the FDIC insurance, or is that in lieu of the FDIC insurance?
Madam Chair, Representative Wand, that's for funds that aren't covered under the FDIC insurance.
Thank you.
Further questions for Mr. Bond before we let's invite Linda Navarro, and if she wants to bring anyone with her. From the bankers, no.
Do you want me to stay?
I think you better stay. Okay. I'm not going to let you off the hook. Just at least stay in the room, Derek.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. I'm Linda Navarro. I'm president and CEO of the Oregon Bankers Association. We sought to have this legislation introduced this session from our view, and I think as Darren very well explained, to clarify in the statute that the limits that are designed to protect the pool participants, that is the banks that share in liability, apply to uninsured funds. In 2007, the new collateral program was put in place, those protections were very important to the pool participants, the banks, to assure that no bank participating in the pool exceeded some of those thresholds. For example, how well capitalized they are requires higher levels of collateral or the 30% aggregate limit on total public funds in the pool. So there was some inconsistency in the 2007 legislation. Uninsured was inserted in some areas of the statute and not in others. And there was an attempt made, I believe, in the February session attached to a bill that provided credit unions with public deposit authority, an attempt to clarify it and essentially removed uninsured from some sections of the statute. What we're seeking to do is add the words uninsured back in consistently throughout the statute because it was designed from the start to provide protection related to uninsured public funds, that is, funds not insured by the FDIC. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
There's anyone.
Okay. So I'm a banker, let's say, and I'm going to get $500,000 from the local water district, and that's going to be on deposit. If I have to 100% collateralize it, then I'm not able to lend it out and leverage it for any loans in my community. Why would I want the money from the public body?
The way, excuse me, Madam Chair, Representative Juan, the way the program was designed initially was based on a program that's been in effect for decades successfully in Washington that worked very well even through the financial challenges of the late 80s and early 90s because the pooled collateral protected the public deposits, but the actual minimum collateral pledged was generally speaking around 10%. That's how it was designed. Unfortunately, we barely had 6 months of our program being in effect when the current financial crisis hit. And instability in the banking industry led for the need to raise that minimum collateral requirement. So it was temporarily raised by the Treasury to 100% under some new authority provided in an amendment to that statute. And that is what made it very expensive. You're absolutely correct that when collateral requirements that are at 100%, it makes it difficult for banks to be able to deploy those public deposits, particularly smaller banks that have to go out and buy a dollar of collateral for every dollar of deposits taken. That said, some banks have pretty expansive relationships with their public entities and are selectively able to provide that depository service. They're also utilizing the unlimited temporary transaction account coverage that's in place and a program called CEDARS that's in place and some other tools to try to maintain those deposits. But that said, a number of banks have exited the business of accepting public deposits. I can cite one example of a bank because I just looked it up last week U.S. Senator Merkley's office, and that is a bank that had, if I'm recollecting correctly, about $80 million. It's a community bank headquartered in Oregon, had about $80 million in public deposits in 2007, and today they have less than $40 million. I think it might even be less than $30 million. And the reason that they've been able to maintain some, if you look at their call report, they've shifted and increased the balance of insured funds because they're able to use these insured vehicles that are temporarily in place, but they almost have taken virtually to zero their collateralized funds, essentially exiting the pool because of how expensive it is. But the fact is, it's not an easy situation because there are banks that oppose sharing liability in this environment because you are on the hook if there was a bank failure and you were charged to cover that bank's public funds on a pro rata basis through your participation in the pool. So you've got banks that are very concerned about a low threshold for minimum collateral because that increases their exposure. But just to put it in perspective, and this is my final, comment, unless there are more questions, the likelihood of a loss to a pool is very, very rare. That's why there was never a loss to the Washington pool when we modeled Oregon's program after that, and we put more parameters in place to protect the pool participants. Because a bank must fail with public funds that have not been increased to 110% collateral, and that's an authority the Treasurer has always had to increase a troubled bank's collateral requirements to 110%, whatever the minimum for the whole pool is. So that has to have not happened, A, and B, when the bank fails or is closed by the regulators, there has to be no other bank acquiring the deposits, the uninsured deposits of that bank, and almost every single failure, everyone in Oregon has involved the acquisition of all deposits. So the stars really have to line up. That said, they did in Vancouver, or in Clark County, Washington, with the Bank of Clark County, and there was a loss to the Washington Pool, the first ever in decades, and that's what prompted a lot of the concern and reasons for increasing minimum collateral for all participating banks on a temporary basis. Thank you.
Further questions? Yes.
Could you describe briefly, CDOR, I understand, that has to do with 2613.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that you mentioned, temporary something, mm-hmm. I don't understand. Could you describe that briefly?
Sure, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair. The during this financial crisis, there was concern about stability and stability within the industry and, you know, preventing a migration of deposits out of insured financial institutions. So under authority from the Congress, the FDIC instituted some programs, some temporary liquidity guarantee programs and some other transaction account guarantee programs. One of the key ones that's been utilized by most banks is the ability for an extra fee that they pay to provide unlimited insurance on transaction accounts. For a period of time, it was a very low interest-bearing transactions account, less than 50 basis points they had to be paying. Today, with the extension of that program, it's zero interest transaction accounts. So it's only for interest, non-interest-bearing transaction accounts. It helps small businesses, for example, and public entities have full coverage on accounts that they may use for payroll, for example, or, you know, their checking account for paying their operating expenses. So it's a temporary program that will be unwound, I believe, at year end.
Representative Warren, you had further questions.
So we have a temporary, we have an economic problem, a significant one. Then we have a temporary liquidity program from the FDIC that requires our community banks to hold more cash. Then the regulators come in and say you need to hold more, the banking regulators separate from the FDIC come in and say you need to hold more cash, and they increase the capitalization requirements. Then at the same time, our Treasury Department for Public Funds requires 100% collateralization of all uninsured funds. Did I miss anything where we reduced the amount of liquidity in our economy over the last 3 years? And as a follow-up, before you answer that question as well, has anyone calculated the economic impact and how this relates to the lending problem that we keep hearing about, where small businesses can't get loans to stay in business and continue to hire people, and whether perhaps some of these reactions were a little bit of an overreaction, and whether we are now in the doldrums of a jobless recovery because we acted a little too hastily.
Madam Chair, Representative Wand, that's certainly a big nut. Everyone has their opinions on whether the federal government acted appropriately. I can tell you that there are certainly a number of pressures that banks are under right now, regulatory pressures, pressures to maintain increased capital, to meet new every week we're seeing new rules being promulgated that impact a bank's ability to do business. And I certainly have my concerns about the ability of community banks to maintain a competitive opportunity in the face of these challenges. But you know, the issue of public deposit protection is extremely complex, and I will say that in the absence of any other alternative, such as FDIC coverage of public deposits, then the state has to have something, because I don't see a day that public entities would be willing to go back to where there wasn't collateral pledged. Just to clarify, in some states like California, public deposits are protected by standalone collateral, as Oregon had prior to the pooled model. If that's not at 100%, those deposits aren't protected at 100%. And that's where we got the pressure to move toward a new model in Oregon. The public entities wanted essentially 100% or close to protection. We looked at a model like California where they simply increased the collateral up to 100 or 125%, and community banks generally didn't fare well in that environment because it's costly. On the flip side, we looked at models. You have states like Idaho, who've yet to institute any public deposit protection. Public depositors are faced with the same protection that businesses and individuals are faced with. So we looked at the hybrid model in Washington as the best solution available to us at the time. Clearly, as Darren said, a pretty messy proposition when you look at the patchwork of expenses and rules associated with public deposit protection across the country. But until it's addressed at the federal level, we've yet to find a model that's necessarily better than the one we have here in Oregon. If we did, we'd be looking seriously at it.
Thank you. Thank you. Further questions for these two folks? Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate you coming in, and we appreciate the discussion. did you have anything to add? You at one point?
I think that was answered.
Yeah, this was a good discussion, and with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2612, and I'm going to open a public hearing on both House Bill 2553 and House Bill 3543. They are closely related bills and concern themselves with the way the kicker is kicked. And I'll let Paul introduce them.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are many aspects to the kicker.
We're going to talk about just one, right?
One right now, yes. And this aspect is, if, you know, a lot of the language from the original kicker was put verbatim into the Constitution, but there is the way in which the kicker is returned to individuals and corporations is strictly statutory. So that decision remains up to you in the statutes. And what these two bills do, they're very similar, is they propose to change the method of returning the personal kicker back to individual taxpayers. And when the kicker first came into being in 1979, it was set up as a credit on your tax return. So when you were filling out your tax return due April 15th, there would be on your return a notification that there's a kicker credit available, and you take that credit on your return. In 1995, the legislature changed that payment process for individuals, not for corporations, for the non-corporate kicker to become a refund. Now the way the system works is the state economist certifies what the kicker amount is, and then notifies the Department of Revenue. The Department of Revenue then goes through and calculates the percentage kicker for individual taxpayers based on their pre-credit liability now, and then cuts a refund check for individuals, mails those out, and statutorily those have to go out before December 15th. And you saw in terms of the presentation earlier that there are some implications for cash flow under this process, because those large payments go out usually in October and November, early in the biennium. So what these two bills would do is change that back to a credit process, which would mean that we would see the cash flow impact. There would be no difference in terms of the revenue impact, but the cash flow impact would be spread throughout the filing season. So anywhere beginning probably through February through April. So that would spread out that impact on the cash flow. It would also have an impact on overall costs from the Department of Revenue. Right now, there is a surplus kicker cost account that's established within the general fund, and the Department of Revenue's cost on the last kicker, I believe, was about $900,000, slightly less than $1 million for that refund process. The other potential cost of the refund process is, as you saw through the cash flow, was the possibility of additional TANs borrowing during that early period and the interest costs that would be associated with that. So those would be the potential fiscal implications. The bills themselves are very similar. There are a couple of differences in 3543. One of the things that comes up in the process with the kicker refunds and credits, since the change was made in 07 to go to a pre-credit liability, you have the possibility that the kicker credit may be greater than the liability of a taxpayer. So the House Bill 2553 does is basically follow the same process that's done for corporations and allows a carry forward. So individuals could then carry forward any unused kicker credit available into future years. House Bill 3543 does is it makes the, in those cases is where liability is exhausted, it makes the credit refundable. So that's a different approach in House Bill 3543. The other difference is that there is some language in that bill that requires the Department of Revenue to make information on the credit available no later than January 15 in those relevant years where the credit takes place. I believe I have representatives.
Yes, you had a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you walk me through, give me a sample tax year. So let's just say we have a 2010 tax year, and this is totally in our dream world. So then there's a kicker that is due back from the 2010 tax year. When does notice, under the current law, when does notice go out to the taxpayers, and when is it refunded under current statutes? Because I'm trying to understand this.
Representative Mayor Brewer, the credit is based... let's say that, as you say in our dreams, at 09-11 we have a surplus revenue. In that case, you wouldn't know what that is until August of 11.
Okay.
So that's when the state economists would certify what that is in August of 11. And that would be in a percentage basis based on the estimate. You wouldn't know exactly what 2010 liability is, but you have a very good estimate of it. In fact, in the early years, it used to be that it was based on the current year liability, which was very much an estimate, obviously, because it wasn't over. So that was changed to 2010 when we went to the refund process. So what that means is then the Department of Revenue would have those returns for the prior year. It would take that percentage, and then it would go through and calculate what that refund would be. And then it would send that out based on that percentage. Now, that would go out before December 15. What would happen here under the conversion to a credit is it would still be the same calculation. It's just that percentage then, and under 3543, the Department of Revenue would be required to notify everyone what that percentage is, and then when they fill out their returns, it would be based on their 2010 tax year returns.
So just to clarify, in August of the post year, we know what the percentage is per taxpayer. And what I'm getting at is under any of these bills that they have an opportunity for some tax planning while that tax year is still going on, versus waiting like in this one for notice being given in January the following tax year, so they don't have any planning. I'm just trying to understand. So taxpayers would have information under the current method. In August of that year, basically, they conceivably could have some information.
Representative Brewer, the percentage would be based on the prior year, so they wouldn't know until that year was over, because they wouldn't know until August of the following year.
Right, but they would know. That answers. Thank you.
We have Representative Parrish here, and her bill is House Bill 3543. Please come and tell us. Welcome.
Thank you.
You can see we have mobs of people here.
Yeah, this
fascinated.
This is nothing like my committees where they're packed. To every single one is packed. I'm Julie Parrish. I am the representative from House District 37, and I'm bringing you House Bill 3543. And the genesis for this bill really came a few years ago as we were getting the kicker distribution back. And there was an article in the Oregonian specifically talking about the cost to the state to administer the kicker tax. And this was the notion that because we were borrowing the money that we were paying back taxpayers and we were borrowing it out of the normal tax cycle, we were incurring, and I was able to check with the folks, Paul Warner was able to get me some great data, you know, we borrowed $26 million of interest and had a $1 million administrative cost just to redistribute the kicker back to people. Now, this is not about where you feel about the kicker. This is simply a process bill that says there might be a better way to do this, and there might be a way to do it in the normal tax cycle that would have some potential realized dollars for the state. You know, personally around the kicker, I still think it, you know, I'd like to see it go back to voters to have that conversation. That's neither here nor there, but no matter where you stand, I think voters feel like they can spend this money more, you know, effectively or not. The interesting thing that I learned in this process, though, and working with Paul and getting this information back and forth was that, you know, we do this. The kicker tax actually created a federal tax liability for Oregonians, 15 cents on the dollar. And in the subsequent year, we actually saw our tax money from the feds come back higher the year after the kicker tax. Now, how much of that's related to us sending more money to them, I don't know. But and then the other interesting point around kicker tax and is that, you know, looking at how much charity goes out, our Oregonians actually, in a year we got back $1 billion, also donated $2 billion. So clearly Oregonians are using this money. I just want to make sure that if we have a way to save it, and through the administration process, that there's another way to get there and still get them those dollars so that they can do things what they're doing with them right now, which is currently putting those dollars in their community. $6 million of this kicker went back to the state schools fund because folks checked the box and said, you know, donate it back. So Oregonians, I think, want to choose where to use those dollars. But if we can at least save $25, $30 million on the next time, someday maybe we'd have a distribution of kicker, at least let's put some savings in the system administratively for how this money gets back to Oregonians, no matter what that looks like on the rest of the kicker bills that y'all are hearing. So that's my song and dance for the morning.
Thank you, Representative Parrish. Questions for the representative?
Yes, I do. Representative Parrish, I actually really like this bill. I like both of them. I prefer yours over the other, only in the fact that if we're going to give back money, it should be given back and not carried forward. It makes the taxpayers have an interest-free loan on 2553 to the state, but I do like the idea of lowering the cost. I do have a couple improvements that I might suggest, and it speaks to the questions that I asked Mr. Warner. If we know in August of the following tax, so again, in the dream world, 2010, in August of 2011, our taxpayers get information, they're going to get a kicker. You're suggesting then that when they file their 2011 tax return, that the kicker will be a credit on their 2011 tax return.
Or a refund, if it's refund due, right?
Or a refund, no, exactly, but that it will be a refundable credit on their 2011 tax return.
On the 2010 tax return, because they're filing in 2011, is that?
Well, they won't know for the 2010 filing season if there's a kicker yet.
Okay.
So in 2011, in August of 2011, the kicker is calculated. There's a kicker coming back, and you're suggesting that it be made a refundable credit, and that it be made a refundable credit on the 2011 tax return, and that notice would be going out then, if I read this correctly, by January 15th of 2012. To the taxpayers, because you have a January. What I would recommend, if we have calculated it reasonably in August of 2011 in this scenario, that we back up the notice to October or November, giving the state opportunity to provide notice. And the reason for that is it allows taxpayers then to adjust their withholdings, to lower their withholdings or estimated tax payments so that they, in effect, get their kicker in 2011, but we've shifted the administrative burden from the state to the taxpayers to just do their calculation, and therefore then they will have less withholdings or estimated payments on their 2011 return. And so that would be the only tweaking that I would do, because that then makes it taxpayer-friendly and removes the administrative burden from the state and makes the playing field very fair. Do you have an objection to that?
No objection to that. You could happily put that in as amendment, because I will defer to you as the CPA on that.
Thank you.
That's the right choice to make.
Questions on that? I think we're going to have need to hear from Department of Revenue at some point on this and other possibilities on this timing, but I think this is an interesting idea.
So, okay. Well, if you don't need me, then I will
thank you for
run to the next meeting.
Perry.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm going to ask the Department of Revenue to come up and talk a little bit about the timing of this, your take on it.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue.
Thank you.
Thank you. The notice, as I understand it, is in House Bill 3543 as January 15th, following the end of the biennium. So in the example you were talking about, that would be January 15th of 2012. I don't see any reason why we could not do that in October, or even once we have the estimate from Department of Administrative Services. I'm sorry, once we have the percentage from Department of Administrative Services, we could post that on our website at that time. And we typically get that September, so that would be no problem. It may just say once the estimate or once the percentage has been determined, the department will post it on its website. We'd be happy to do that.
But you could, I think it would be also important that not just a posting, but a notification to the taxpayer, because I think that's what you're speaking to, Representative Brewer, that the taxpayer could actually do some planning because they actually can calculate.
Madam
not
Chair,
a website, but a notice.
A mailing to the taxpayer,
a mailing,
Madam Chair.
Or
that's an expensive.
Well, and that's my question, because I think this bill says that there would be... Oh, the information is available. That would be a posting.
Madam Chair, that's how I understand it.
Okay.
Madam Chair,
yeah.
It would seem to me, and I defer to Representative Brewer on this, once you've made it public what the information is, presumably in addition to posting on your website, you issue a press release, it's going to hit the papers, the newspapers. Every accountant in the state will know about it very quickly because of the processes that they use. Without having to actually mail a notice to every taxpayer, that would get around pretty fast, it would seem to me.
Well, and do you have a way of notifying tax preparers of things like this? Do you have a system whereby you...
Madam Chair, we maintain a listserv for tax practitioners who, if they sign up for that listserv, that goes out on an as-needed basis. Our experience has been that Chair Barnhart's representation is correct, that especially when it's in more than 18% kicker, the news travels quickly. So,
I understand. It does. Okay.
And if I could follow
yeah.
up, then I'm assuming that you have to put this somewhere in the instructions for the tax returns themselves. And I'm not sure when those get printed.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, the instructions we are working on now, and they typically go to the printer September or October, of for 2011 tax year, those forms will go to the printer later in the fall, so September or October.
So, if I could follow up. So you need the information that Representative Brewer was talking about before they go to the printer anyway.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's correct. So if this were to be back on the tax return, yes, we would have that percentage.
So there's no reason not to make it public at that point.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's correct.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions from other members of the committee? Yes. Deborah.
If I could just make a couple of points. Dr. Warner described the process that we used to have when this was a credit on the return, And it, if you think of how your tax return flows, taxable income, you calculate the tax on that, you take credits against the tax, and you get to a net tax liability. And that used to be the figure that was on the return multiplied by the percentage to get the kicker credit that you would then reduce your liability. He described moving in 2007, I believe it was, to tax before credits, and the result was that people who had zero liability could still get a kicker. The next session, we you changed that to provide that it would be after the credit for taxes paid to other states, because we had sent a number of refund checks to out-of-state taxpayers with no liability. The provisions in this bill make an additional change, and I just want to point this out because this is this will have some administrative complications, I think, for us. The credit, if it were in effect now, would, as you described, be claimed on the 2011 return, but the liability for determining that credit would be from the 2010 tax return. And that's going to be a little bit of an issue for the taxpayers, because they're going to have to find their 2010 tax return, take the number before credits except after a credit for taxes paid to another state, and use that number on their 2011 return, multiply it by the percentage that we print on the return to determine their 2011 credit. And I just want to make everyone aware of that, because there will be mistakes. They will use the wrong number from the 2010 return. They won't be able to find their 2010 return, so they'll need to call us and ask what that number is. We may get to the point before the next kicker that we can have that information on the website, so someone could go look at their account and find that number there, and that would make it much easier. But I don't know what the software companies will be able to do with the programming. They should be able to do it just fine.
Good point. Representative.
Thank you. To speak to that point, I would think, just from practice, taxpayers that have more than one state taxation, that they would probably have some tax practitioner helping them. A lot of the freebie and lower cost software doesn't really do that well, so that might help. But even if it did have some administrative costs from the state, it would still be less, I would think, than overall of where we're at now.
Madam Chair, Representative Eric Brewer, I think that would be correct. Yes, it should be certainly less than $900,000 to do that.
I hope.
And if I could make one other point, and I was checking with Ken to see how this works. On lines 2 through 4 on page 4, this particular refund would not bear interest. And I don't know whether that would be a difficult provision in the programming or setting this up. I think in process we would treat this just as a withholding, additional withholding, that the taxpayer would be entitled to claim. And if we pay refunds more than 45 days after the return is filed, we pay interest on that. So there would be a separation here between what is entitled to interest and the kicker piece that isn't entitled to interest. We may have other refundable credits that also don't bear interest, but I would want to check on that and make sure that there isn't a problem by treating this as non-interest accruing refund. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, may I?
Yes, Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two things. One is in response, and another is a different issue. By giving notice in advance for taxpayers to adjust their withholding and estimated tax payments, not all taxpayers, but many of them, I would agree to treat this like withholdings would be fair, because we are also giving adequate notice to taxpayers to adjust their cash flow out. It won't be fair 100% to all taxpayers, particularly those that wouldn't have a 2011 withholding or estimated tax payment liability. Right. To those few taxpayers, it won't be equitable, but to the others, it will be substantially equitable, because they are given an opportunity. And I hope if we go this route, when the Department of Revenue gets to posting it on their website and other news agencies, that there also would be available a simple calculation that taxpayers can go through to pre-calculate out what their tax kicker refund would be. and that would be a fairly easy thing to do. Can you speak to your thoughts on this, or if this is going to be large for you, to the extent that we have taxpayers continuing again on this scenario that would not have a 2011 filing requirement but are still entitled to a kicker from 2010? Would that be a lot of I mean, they would still need to file then in order to get this refund back. Would that be typically a large cost there, or is it negligible, or how has that been historic? I mean, what's your feel on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Eric Brewer, the proposal in the bill to use the prior year tax as the calculation is new. So what we have done up until this point is it's based on the prior year tax, but we send the check. Mm-hmm. So there isn't really a filing requirement in order to get the check. So that would be, as I understand this, we would need to, if we didn't get a return in, would we need to calculate the kicker based on the prior year liability and send that? And that's a really good question. I hadn't thought about that. It may be that there wouldn't be a kicker unless there is a return filed for 2011. Because if we were to calculate it, for example, assuming they didn't need to file a 2011 return and send them the check, and it were the case that they just hadn't gotten around to filing the 2011 return yet, we would have a problem. So I think there probably needs to be some clarity as to what happens when a 2011 return isn't required or isn't filed.
Yeah, go ahead.
Just a thought on that. Because this is a refundable credit and it's based on the prior year's tax liability, the fact that someone wouldn't have a current year liability, it seems disequitable that they wouldn't get it. So it's just to me, and so I would think that they're still entitled to it. It's just a matter of figuring out the process then in that case.
Further questions?
I want to follow up a little bit on this, if I may. Do we know what percentage of taxpayers file a return in 1 year and then the next year they don't because they are no longer required to file? I would think that there's a bunch of reasons why that might happen. One would be that you didn't survive into the next year. One might be that your income declined significantly so that you no longer were required to file a return. But that might get at the question that Representative Brewer is asking about the what percentage of situations in which that would arise.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, I think we can probably run a query and look at a given year and see how many did not file the subsequent year. We wouldn't know why.
Yeah, some of those were probably people who should have filed.
Yes.
But if I could, Madam Chair, following up, is there a disadvantage to somebody who's not required to file, other than the fact that they have to fill out the return? Is there a disadvantage to them to file anyway in order to get a benefit like this one? Is it possible that they could end up incurring a tax that they wouldn't otherwise be required to tell us about because they're not required to file a return?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, if they were required to file a return...
No, if they were not required to file a return.
If they were not required to file a return, then they should not end up with a tax liability
that
they didn't tell us about.
All right. Those two, if I may, those two things link together. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Of this of Department of Revenue. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think that this brings more questions that we will be in contact with you about.
Good direction.
Yeah. I wonder if anyone else would like to speak on this issue. Who's here today? Nobody's rushing forward. Committee members, I think this will be under further discussion. I would like to hear from you, your thoughts on this, and I think Representative Barnhart would too.
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
Before we spend a lot of energy, let's kind of get a feel for where the committee might want to be going with this. So we would appreciate input. Without further questions, I'm going to close the public hearings on House Bill 2553 and House Bill 3543 and close today's Revenue Committee meeting.
Hey, bravo.
Thank you.
Thank you. Nicely done.
Well, you know, we could go back to the 37
minutes
calculation.